This is podtech.net. I'm Catherine Girardeau. We're podcasting today from the TICON conference in Santa Clara. Coming up is a presentation from negotiations guru David Seibel. David is co-founder and president of Insight Partners. He's an attorney, conflict management consultant, mediator, and professor in the fields of effective negotiation, communication, and mediation. In this podcast, David Seibel lays out a systematic framework for thinking about and conducting negotiations.
I'm going to start by introducing you to very, very common sense tension. It's the substance relationship tension. This is at the backbone of all the work that I do. And when some of the professors at Harvard Law School who wrote Getting to Yes took a look at the landscape of best advice on negotiation practice in the late 1970s, they found that it fell primarily into two basic camps. The first was on substance. Advice in this category was try to keep the other side guessing, right? The purpose here is to get as much substance for yourself as you possibly can. Get the biggest piece of the pie possible. Get the entire pie if you can. Other advice would be keep them guessing, throw them off balance whenever possible, disclose nothing. There's an obvious downside. The upside is maybe obvious to most of you. The upside is you actually can get short-term gains in substance with some of those strategies following some of that advice. The downside is obvious. It's very hard to go back to the table and negotiate with those same people again. They'll be prepared. In addition to actually undermining relationship with those kinds of techniques, there's also a very high risk of leaving value on the table. This led to a whole other school of thought, which is focused on relationships. Here, the idea is to actually try to preserve relationships at all costs. Advice would sound something like, make concessions early, it'll pay off later. Give up substance for the sake of the relationship. The upside, people leave the negotiation table feeling good about each other. The downside, is that the person who's giving up the substance ends up actually not getting what they want. Not to mention that the relationship ultimately suffers because if you keep making concessions over time, you start to resent that dynamic. So our goal as an organization is to help people deal with this basic tension that most people experience in all of their negotiations. And by the way, when I say negotiation, I'm thinking very broadly, not just a traditional trying to negotiate the term sheet for financing. I'm talking about any situation where people are trying to influence other people. In those situations, when you're dealing with a substance relationship tension, where we hope we can help people get to is this northeast quadrant, to try to take the best advice from both worlds. The assumptions that we have, the mindset that you have going into a negotiation is going to dictate how you act. And those actions are going to produce results. Some people get caught in the trap where they get results they don't like, they go back and they act again, maybe they act louder, maybe they push harder because they're still not getting the results they want, and now they're just in a reaction cycle. It's action, results, action, results. What we tend to find we need to do with most people, especially people who are very experienced negotiators, who have lots of assumptions about what this negotiation is going to look like, is get them to go back another step and think about mindset. Think about the assumptions that they're making. The assumption here was, if I'm going to win and get a lot of points, they have to lose. The shift is, actually, it doesn't matter how much they get, as long as I get as much as I possibly can. Assumptions affect the actions, which affect the results. A lot of our work is focused on helping people create value before running to distributing value. That's what was happening there. You immediately assume there was a fixed amount of time, a fixed amount of points that were probably possible, and you go and grab for it. We spend a lot of our time helping people not only first think about how to expand the pie before they do anything else, but then when they go to divide it in a way that doesn't damage relationships. Here's how we do it. Okay, if you take a negotiation and describe its component parts, you could describe the negotiation process as having four main categories. There's what you do in preparation, there's conduct, the actual negotiation itself, and there's an outcome, hopefully it's a good outcome, and then you review. The most successful organizations, the most successful negotiators, spend a lot of time in all four of these circles. When we start talking about a structured framework, we're actually going to start by discussing the outcome, how to measure success. Why are we starting with how to measure success? The answer is obvious, because you have to know your destination in order to know what to pack, in order to know what turns to make when you're on the journey. And when you get to the end, you can actually look back and make sure that the organization is actually capturing the lessons learned from that experience, whether things went well or poorly. You don't want the rest of your organization to be reinventing the wheel with every negotiation. Make sense? Okay. Our goal is to find one simple, straightforward, structured framework that will actually help you to deal with all four of these parts of a negotiation process. I'm not going to be able to go into depth with all parts of that structured framework today, but I am going to show you that entire framework. What we're building up to by the end of the time that I have is a single image that includes seven elements, seven particular pieces of a negotiation puzzle that I want to leave you with. Before I do that, I need to actually just highlight how most people measure success. That's where we're going to start. This, when we actually interview people time and time again, is a summary of the kinds of definitions of success most people have when they think of negotiation. There's the winning version, and there's the, well, I didn't lose version. I just want to explore some of these very briefly. Let's take an example. Jim, if you could drive any car in the world right now, what would it be?
A Mercedes-Benz.
Okay. For the purposes of this little exercise, you now own a Mercedes-Benz, and you want to sell it to me. How much would you sell it for?
$100,000.
This is the diamond-encrusted Mercedes-Benz. I want to actually buy this car. I want to buy this model. And I want to spend $10,000. We get into a traditional haggle. We go back and forth. And I end up getting the car for $15,000. Based on this first measure of success, who won that negotiation? I did, right? I made fewer concessions. I only went up $5,000. He came down from $100,000. What if I told you that the actual market value of the car that I just bought was $5,000? Who won that negotiation? He did. And Jim did, because you would say, well, he broke my bottom line, he got a better deal, it was more than maybe he actually expected for the car. Let's take another quick example. I'm taking this example. I used to tell this example just as a hypothetical, and then I went to a very famous clothing store in Boston. They have a very famous basement, but I won't name names. It turns out that this actually happens there. Manager is trying to sell a suit, a men's suit. It's on sale for $599. Doesn't move. It's there for weeks. What does the manager do to get rid of it? He's going to put it on sale. So the tag says $599. He goes over and puts $799 above that and crosses $799 out. If it still doesn't sell, what does he do? He's going to have a bigger sale. He writes $999 above it and crosses it out, and writes next to it, one day sale, going out of business, liquidation. What does the store manager know? What is he doing there? Yeah, he's playing on the fact that most people have these measures of success. He's playing on our perceptions of getting a deal, of breaking a bottom line. It feels like we broke the store's bottom line. They wanted to sell it for $9.99. This is almost half price. Okay, you get the point. These are very, very simple examples to highlight the idea that if you walk around with measures of success like these, it's easier for people to take advantage of you. It's also more likely that you'll leave value on the table. We want to actually offer a different way to measure success, and I'm going to do that through this model called the seven elements, and I'm going to do the lightning version. This is like a lightning round. The first two or three elements I'll go a little bit slower on, because I think they're so important to actually convey to you how a model like this can work. Okay. We start with measuring success with alternatives. The concept here is simple. It's what you can do away from the negotiation table, without the consent of the person you're negotiating with. In the example of the car, What are some of Jim's alternatives? If he doesn't reach a deal with me, what can he do? Yeah, he can sell it to somebody else, right? What can I do? I could buy somebody else's car. You know, if he can't sell it to me, he could also consider making a charitable donation. He could run it off a cliff and try to collect the insurance. Don't know if I advise that, but my point is it doesn't require my consent, so it's an alternative. When he's not looking, I could steal his car. It doesn't require his consent. It's an alternative. The question I have for most people when we get to this point is, why am I starting here? Why is this so important? We're trying to measure success, but we're actually trying to get to a deal, and we're starting with alternatives away from the table. The answer is intuitive. You need a benchmark. You need to know what the best possible alternative is to this agreement. And that acronym, BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement, this appears in the book Getting to Yes, is something you need to know before you walk into the negotiation. Why? Because this is where power comes from, or it's one of the key sources of power in a negotiation. As an example that may affect your world more closely, an employee actually wants to get a raise. They come to you to try to get a raise, or you're going to your boss. If the employee actually has in their back pocket an offer from another company for twice the salary, that employee coming to you is not going to have much incentive to actually make concessions and say, well, I'll take less money. They're not going to say, well, I'll take a little bit of money, because in their minds, they have a strong BATNA. Same thing goes for the employer. On the employer side, if you have another person lined up who's willing to do the job and you think can do it just as well for a lesser amount of money, you're not so incented to actually go up, right? BATNA can give you power. In the investment world, an entrepreneur has an idea. They want to create a company. The company's been going for some time now. And there is a group of investors who are all interested in investing. One of those investors says, here's the deal. I'll invest this money, but only if I get all of these preferred terms. Well, from the entrepreneur's perspective, if there are many, many other investors, they have the ability to push back and say, no, because I can actually go to these other investors who don't need those preferred terms. But what happens when there's only one investor who's actually biting? Now you have an entrepreneur who feels pressure, who has pressure to actually concede on substance in order to preserve the deal so that they end up with something. Our best advice, when you're thinking about BATNAs, first of all, know them before you walk in. The measure of success is that an agreement should be better than your BATNA. Otherwise, walk away. Unbelievable how many people make deals. And then I've coached them, let's say, and they go into the deal, and then they come out, they have a deal, and I say, great, what is it? They tell me the deal, and it's worse than their BATNA. Even after I've prepped them this way, it's worse than their BATNA. There's something about deal momentum psychology where it feels good to actually be making a deal. Measure of success, just to repeat it again so it rings in your ears, know your BATNA, and make sure you don't make a deal unless it's better than your BATNA. Interests. In order to figure out which of the alternatives is actually your BATNA, you need to have an understanding of which one best meets your needs. That's what interests are. I have to make a clear distinction here. Positions. Positions are demands. They're what people say they want. Interests are the underlying motivating factors, the reasons why they're holding those positions. The classic story, it's in Getting to Yes. I feel the need to say it to every group just because so many people know it. Two children are in a kitchen. They're arguing over the last remaining orange. It's mine, it's mine. No, it's mine, it's mine. Parent walks in, cuts the orange in half, gives one half to each child, and then watches. One child takes his half of the orange, peels the rind, throws the rind in the trash, and eats the fruit, and then looks around the kitchen for something else to eat. He's still hungry. The other child takes her half, peels the rind, throws the fruit in the trash, and uses the rind to bake a cake for a school project that called for one entire orange rind. What's the problem with the outcome? Yeah, wasted value. Wasted value. In this case, 50% of the value in that deal was literally thrown in the trash. The science here is to actually know, to ask why. Don't negotiate over positions. Get to interests. The art is knowing when you've gotten to one that's actually helpful. Why is it so important to get to an underlying interest? Because then it opens up the world of expanding the pie to other options, like the option of getting a different piece of fruit and a different person getting it. We try to get at the interest so that we can actually identify all the options possible. I have time to do just one more very quickly. By the way, the measure of success there, an agreement adequately meets the party's interests, not their positions. Okay, let's do one more. And in terms of options, the idea is to get as many as possible out on the table, not to just agree with the first one you arrive at. For some of you, you might know the Pareto curve. Pareto was an Italian economist who came up with the 80-20 rule. That was that 20% of the people in Italy were owning 80% of the land. Well, we borrowed another one of his ideas to apply to the negotiation context. If you have on one axis good for me, here you have good for you. We're talking about value, substance. Most deals, the curve, the Pareto curve. The curve is the point, in theory, at which the deal cannot get better for one without getting worse for the other. Most deals, when you plot them, they'll come out somewhere around here. It's pretty good for me, that good. It's pretty good for you, it's that good. The problem is, it leaves all of that wasted value. Even though we reached a point where we could agree, so it met my interest enough for me to say yes, there's more power in realizing that there's a theoretical point in the distance that you actually could get to. And I'll make this my last point just in terms of timing. Your job as a negotiator is to make sure that you've actually pushed towards this Pareto frontier. Okay, I'm gonna jump right to the place where I can pull these together. The next one, I'll just tell you what they are. The next element has to do with objective criteria. Right? Once you get to the point where you've expanded the pie and you do have to divide it, look for objective criteria, standards. In your worlds, that might be something like doing a market analysis. Don't take my word for the value of the company. Here's a market analysis. Here are similar deals that have been done. Those are objective standards, right? That will help you actually choose which option you want to go with. The other three elements are interpersonal. Communication. Do you have a quality of communication and a process set up that actually is effective? The agreement should be based on clear, efficient, and effective communication. Relationships. Agreements should improve or at least not damage the relationship. It is possible to do that and still go for an incredible amount of substance. If I had more time with you, I'd give you specific examples of how to do that. We'll have to talk about that maybe in question and answer or maybe another time. The last element is commitment. This is essentially the flip side of options. Options are all the things you could possibly do together. Commitment is what you actually agree you are going to do together. The measure of success, they should be clear, realistic, and better than your BATNA before you say yes. You put all these together, and you have a list for measuring success that is completely different than saying, I made fewer concessions than the other side. This is a measure of success that will actually make a company grow. What I love about this model, those seven elements that I just gave you, is they apply to these other circles as well. So let me just show you that last image that I promised. This is a traditional haggle. This is what most people find themselves doing at some point when they're distributing value. I take an extreme position, you take a low one, we go back and forth, and hopefully we reach a deal in the middle. Instead, this is what we recommend. This is the image that's burned in the back of my brain. This is what's making my business run, is helping people work this roadmap. If you don't have communication and relationship aligned properly, you'll never get people to actually come forth and tell real interests. If you can't get the interest out, you'll never generate the full range of possible options and you'll leave value on the table. If you don't have objective standards for legitimacy, you'll end up haggling instead of distributing value in a rational way. Once you actually end up with a set of options that seem legitimate to you, you have to look at your BATNA. If it's not better than your BATNA, you say no. If it's better than your BATNA, you say yes and you commit. And I'm going to stop right there. I hope there was something in that was helpful for all of you. Thank you.